And we are back for the final G-Staff draft, the Storm of Swords one. Preston, please remind the audience that there will be no Dance of Dragons. It was Feast, Game of Thrones, Clash, right. And Storm.
Well, or a Dance with Dragons was already done, like with Feast. I mean, maybe later stuff, you know, will eventually be opened up, but that there are drafts of A Dance with Dragons that are not available to the public. But the early drafts of A Dance with Dragons, it was still combined with A Feast for Crows. And so we already covered that material. The stuff on, you know, there's some stuff on Tyrion and I don't know what other early stuff was there on a Dance with Dragons material. Dany, there's some early Dany stuff we talked about and stuff like that. But we did a video on changes to the draft of Dance with Dragons and Feast for Crows. We have a video on changes of the draft to A Game of Thrones. We have a video on changes to the drafts with A Clash of Kings, and this is our final one. Unless something changes, unless something opens up to the public, but on A Dance with Dragons, but this is the final book of changes of early drafts that George had, and what you know to what he put in the final his published version. And so today we're talking about a Storm of Swords, a Storm of Swords. Now we got to remember the Storm of Swords is a very unusual book. In that George wrote it just at lightning speed, much really? Faster. What? I mean, obviously much, much faster than Dance and Feast, but he wrote it faster than even A Game of Thrones and A Clash of Kings.
Any specific reason? Maybe he was running out of money?
I don't know. Some people theorize that because A Storm of Swords is kind of closing up stories and concluding them, that George is going faster. And I've heard similar stuff like when that some people thought years ago that Winds was going to come out quicker than Dance because he'd be closing up plot lines and resolving stuff and he would get faster. And some people, you know, still say the same thing about A Dream of Spring. They're like, oh, if Winds comes out, then he'll just be wrapping everything up, so it'll be easy for him. He knows exactly where the story is going. I don't buy any of that. I think Storm is fast because George is using a different writing style. He is trying to pump out a book that is a page turner. It's very different in style to the other four. Which is why I think it's also many people's favorite, is that it sticks out. It sticks out with a lot of action. It sticks out where just the writing style is not so precise, with, you know, little references here and there. That A Dance with Dragons and A Feast for Crows is filled with, that I think you and I love, Carmine. We love all the little details that he shoves in there. But it's I don't know. Some people say it's this perfect sweet spot. You know, there's just so much excitement in it, and it's just kind of breezy. You know, John battling on the wall, Tyrion's trial, Lady Stoneheart, Sansa in the veil, purple wedding, you know, Lysa going through the moon door, just so many things like stick out from this book, from A Storm of Swords, as like these great moments. But
to put this in perspective for non-book readers, in the show, Storm of Swords, the third book, was broken up to season 3 and 4 because there was just so much stuff there. They had to just break it up. Otherwise, everything would have been rushed.
Yeah, I suppose. Though, in the show, Arya does wander around the Riverlands quite a bit.
Yeah,
but that's what she does in the... I mean, it's kind of funny because it's like, for the most part, the Arya story from A Clash of Kings and A Storm of Swords, many people think drags because it's just her wandering the Riverlands for two books, meeting various bands of outlaws. You know, like she meets Faceless Men and Amory Lorch's Men and the Brave Companions and the Brotherhood Without Banners and then the Hound. And it's her and outlaws wandering the Riverlands. And then the show just was like, well, we'll just rush it. And she'll meet the Brotherhood Without Banners briefly. And then she'll be with the Hound doing nothing for a while. So, but yeah, but so this discussion of like Storm being so fast means that there's not as many drafts, and like the draft that exists, you know, gets written after it. So this is kind of where we start, as we say that the Library is a Storm of Swords draft is from July 1999, roughly 10 months before George finalized the manuscript, and contains 574 manuscript pages, roughly 38% of the final text. That means George wrote 2/3 of A Storm of Swords in 10 months.
Jesus Christ.
Right?
Those like good days.
This manuscript pages, that's kind of, you know, you can maybe say, oh, that's a lot of leftover from Clash kind of stuff. But it was just such a booming period. That's 1,000 manuscript pages that he wrote in a 10-month
period. So I play this, I unfortunately play this video game Destiny 2, and whenever Destiny 2 comes out with like new cosmetic DLC, the joke in the community is, rent's due. They're putting this out right now because rent's due, and I'm assuming this is why George was writing so fast. Rent was due.
Yeah, it may be. I mean, things were kind of blowing up with it, but Storm of Swords is really the one that where everything blew up. So I don't know. I mean, by comparison, he wrote essentially around 1,000 manuscript pages in 10 months. If we believe his report, he's taken 12 years, 13 years to write 1,000 manuscript pages for Winds. It's just such a strange comparison. But anyway, then he says, by raw word count, the edits to Storm are unquestionably more extensive than for Clash and Game. They mostly take the form of heavier wordsmithing and entire prose. There are no changes to major subplots on the same level as the deletion of Glass Candles from Clash or changes to Victarion's fate late in the writing of Feast, but some of that wordsmithing may have significance to George's biggest mysteries. The best example of, this is kind of interesting because it's not, as you say, in the later books, there's deleted chapters, there's whole subplots, characters that should be dead are not dead. And in Clash, you know, there was the Glass Candle situation, but here he's saying nothing much changes, but little word changes go through are in it. So he spent a lot of time, you know, he breezily wrote quickly and then like went back and edited his own work. He didn't like painstakingly go through it slowly. Anyway, the best example of that comes in with George's edits in the story of the Knight of the Laughing Tree from A Storm of Swords Brand 2. It's Mira telling the story. The protagonist is the young Crannogman, clearly Mira's father, Howland Reed, though she doesn't say that. According to Mira, he could talk to trees and weave words and make castles appear and disappear. The story begins with Howland leaving his home in the Neck and visiting the mysterious Isle of Faces. He spends a winter there with the green men before continuing south. Here's how Howland's time on the Isle of Faces is described in the published book. All that winter the Crannogman stayed on the Isle, but when the spring broke, he heard the wide world calling and knew the time had come to leave. His skin boat was just where he'd left it, so he said his farewells and paddled off towards shore. And this is from the 99 draft. The Crannogman dwelled on the Isle for most of that winter. But when spring broke, he heard the wide world calling and he knew the time had come to leave. His skin boat had just just where he left it. So he said his farewells to the trees and paddled off to shore. So he just said farewell. The difference is he just said to the trees, right? He said the farewell to the trees. So G-Stuff is saying here, these few words, there are a few wording changes here, but the most significant is the shortening of the phrase, said farewell to the trees, to just said his farewells. Reasonable people can differ, but I think that phrase is potentially a major hint that the nature of the green men, are in some sense trees.
is your head swirling that when he's saying goodbye to the trees, he's either saying goodbye to Blood Raven or time traveling Bran?
No, I think so. The problem is the Weirwoods aren't green. You know, if the Weirwoods had green leaves like other trees, and you said, "Oh, they're saying goodbye to the green men," you could say, "Oh, well, the green men are trees because trees are green." You know, but weirwoods aren't green. Weirwoods are red. They have red leaves and white bark. And you could say like, oh, the green is some aspect of nature. And maybe we're supposed to think that the green is some aspect of nature, but we don't know anything. There's no green aspect to weirwoods. So that's what I think is kind of a little weird there. Keep in mind, George's first use of the word green dreams comes from a short story he wrote starring Haviland Tuff for Tuff Voyaging called Guardians. And he describes a hive-minded alien race telepathically talking to each other musically. And he calls their musical thoughts going back and forth to each other green dreams. And so the green, like George's idea of green and like hive-minded telepathy wasn't necessarily related to chlorophyll and like the greenness of nature. It was just a color that he kind of pulled out of nowhere to represent telepathy.
Hmm.
So I don't necessarily think that like the green men are green in the sense that they're like leaves. However, when he says, I think it's just simpler. Like if he's saying farewell to the trees, it may be that like Howland Reed was bonding and connecting to the tree in the same way that Bran was bonding and connecting to the tree, you know, and that like Howland going to the Isle of Faces and leaving is very similar to Bran going to the Blood Raven's cave and leaving or something like that. But anyway, I'm not sure if this is the point, if that's the point that G-Stuff is hinting at or what, but, this doesn't tell me any kind of nature, like thing about the nature of the green men themselves. Like, obviously I think the green men are connected to the Weirwoods somehow, but, anyway, but this shouldn't be too surprising. The story already contains one human tree hybrid, and both Blood Raven and the Green Men have connections to the Children of the Forest. It's not that I don't think the Green Men are connected to the trees. I don't necessarily think that saying goodbye to the trees is saying that the Green Men are trees. I do think the Green Men are like connected to the trees, but I think it's hinting that Howland was connecting to the trees in the same way Bran was, and that he's saying goodbye to them.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I agree with that.
Yeah. Anyway, the limited description of what we have of the Green Men also includes tree-like elements. Later in the same chapter, Bran says to old Nan that the Green Men had leaves instead of hair. Well, That, I mean, that idea does lend to them being green, but again, like weirwood leaves should be red. But I've told you the theory about like why the green men, why the green, the green men have antlers, that they're actually weirwood branches that they've stuck on their heads.
Right, to connect themselves better to the
Yeah.
weirwood net.
Which like is very similar to the Grishka aspect of A Song for Leah. And like it's funny because like when I first heard the theory that the green men had stapled branches to their heads or whatever, at first I was like, that sounds pretty crazy. And then I thought for like just a minute, I was like, no, that really makes sense. That completely makes sense in every George R. R. Martin way that they just were shoved like attaching branches to their heads to try to connect. But anyway, there's a section on the green men in the World of Ice and Fire that says their clothes are green, perhaps misinterpretation of leaves or moss. Don't the children of the forest wear leaves for clothes?
Oh, there's so many different artists' interpretation of the children, and I'm trying not to confuse it with the ones in the show.
Yeah. Blood Raven's nature could be foreshadowing the nature of the Green Men. Sure. There he is. Problems. Old Nan says the Green Men were thought to ride elk, which doesn't sound tree-like. And particularly, and that particular tree that Blood Raven's merging with, the weirwood, is instantly recognized because the trunks and leaves are not green. Yes. So G-Stuff is aware of the same problems here. The alternative interpretation of the deleted said farewell to the trees might be that Howland was able to communicate with the weirwoods and also believed that are also believed to populate the isle, and that the children, the green men, and the weirwoods form a trinity of ice magic mediums that coexist on the isle. Yeah, probably something like that. I think it's just Howland had connected to the weirwoods and then he said goodbye, and that's, you know, who knows what's going on. Yeah, the Green Men are whatever, like that they've attached weirwoods to their head.
And yeah, you're correct. The children of the forest were cloaks of leaves, and they had vines and leaves and flowers in their hair, weaved into their hair.
Yeah. In addition to this change, there are a few other interesting changes to the story of the Knight of the Laughing Tree worth mentioning. One of the next events in Howland's story is that he's attacked by three squires soon after arriving at the tourney. As published, he's rescued by the She-Wolf, who most readers understand to be Lyanna Stark. But in the draft, the Kranig Man is rescued by the Wild Wolf, Brandon Stark, Ned and Lyanna's dead brother. Here's the diversion. And that's my father's men you're kicking. A wolf on four legs or two, said Brand. Two, said Mira. He scattered the squires with a tourney sword, swatting them with the flat of his blade. The Kranig Man was bruised and bloodied, so the wild wolf took him back to his lair where his maiden sister cleaned his cuts and bound him up with linen. Soon the whole pack had gathered in the tent, the wolf squire and serving men and friends, and the two young brothers as well. The middle brother was quiet and serious, the youngest a playful pup. Do you feel about it being Brandon like scattering the people instead of Lyanna?
I like the original, and I feel as though the reason he changed it from Brandon to Lyanna is to probably connect it to the Knight of the Laughing Tree, that she is the Knight of the Laughing Tree.
Well, certainly without Lyanna like going out and smacking him with a tourney sword, you don't get the idea that Lyanna is a tomboy, you
I
know, or
agree.
that, you know, and you kind of need that idea that Lyanna is a tomboy to suspect her as the Knight of the Laughing Tree. On the other hand, Brandon is given so little in the story that it's almost sad that this is taken away from him, because we now know essentially nothing about him to make him seem like a good guy. I mean, you know, he gets angry about his sister and he like goes in to try to rescue his dad and like strangles himself trying to rescue his dad. But we just kind of think of him as being a hot-headed asshole. And this would actually be like a moment where Brandon is trying to defend the meek, you know? It would be an actual positive thing about Brandon Stark, which we don't have in the story.
That makes you make a good point there, but at the same time, the information we later get on Brandon in regards to Barbary Dustin, was that her that he had the okay, I want to go into detail, but that's a good point, but at the same time, I do feel as though George was trying to point the reader that the Knight of the Laughing Tree might have been Lyanna, so that's why the change. He wanted to make that connection there, but yeah, I see your point about Brandon.
Yeah, I mean, it's also interesting that I've read different theories on the Knight of the Laughing Tree, and you know, most fans believe it's Lyanna, but I've had the logic that it's actually Ned. It's just so much more logical that it's Ned. You know, like Ned was raised in the Vale where they would joust more. But if you took this paragraph and then you think of the Knight of the Laughing Tree, you have nothing to really connect it to Lyanna. So you might more quickly assume it's Ned. And that, you know, like Lyanna, it could be that he's making Lyanna the red herring by having her be the star of the story. And then when the Knight of the Laughing Tree appears, you assume it's Lyanna, as most fans do assume it's Lyanna. But if it is Ned, then it's quite, you know, because you're giving the role of caretaker to Lyanna in this. Oh, she cleaned up the cuts. So you're like, oh, she's just a traditional woman. And so now you're like, who's the Knight of the Laughing Tree? Oh, you immediately think it's like one of the guys. So it's probably Ned. While if you make Lyanna the tomboy and star of the story, you start thinking it's Lyanna. And if it is actually Ned, then you know, she's a red herring.
So real quick, I don't mean to jump ahead, but how long is it from Harrenhal incident to the end of Robert's Rebellion? What is that? A year? Almost two?
What, Harrenhal's in 81 or something? 281? And the Robert's Rebellion is 283? Yeah. So
The reason I bring this up is if Howland can, it would make sense if it was Ned, in the sense that when Ned goes to rescue Lyanna, Howland would come with him because they're besties. Maybe Howland figured it out, or maybe Ned told him. But at the same time, it would also make sense if it was Lyanna, because Howland owes her. So that's why he comes with Ned to the Tower of Joy. Because why the fuck would you bring Howland Reed, of all people, to the Tower of Joy when he couldn't even beat up a couple squires? You going to take him to fight Kingsguard? This as someone who does not like Howland Reed. Not because of your reasons, because I know people are going to say, like, you hate Howland Reed, and therefore I got to... No, because Arthur Dayne's the GOAT. How the fuck does Howland Reed beat Arthur Dayne? But yeah, so it actually makes sense both ways.
It does. I mean, the thing is, it's so abstract and so little information that a lot of different solutions make sense. There's another small difference in the above passage worth mentioning. The pup is generally assumed to be the youngest Stark, Benjen, but in the published version, it doesn't include the word playful. By the time we meet Benjen at the wall, he is described as dark and serious. Others have suggested Something may have changed Benjen's personality around the time he joined the Watch. The description of young Benjen as playful could be considered more evidence of this. Yeah, I mean, we get asked this all the time. People ask me all the time, like, why did Benjen join the Night's Watch? Like, what was the reason? And yeah, if you could just say, well, for honor or whatever, but there seems to be something more to that. And if you describe him as playful and then serious, well, then there's been some major change to the guy. I mean, for instance, Aaron Dampere was a playful dude, and then he went through a life-changing experience of nearly dying, and then all of a sudden was very different, was dark and serious. So, you know, you're expecting some other huge change in Benjen's character, but then he just removed the word playful. So maybe he was dark and serious from the beginning. Who knows? Anyway, in the draft version, it also contains a deleted reference to Rhaegar's newborn son being present. The king presented his new grandson to the lords assembled on the Golden Shield, which, I mean, it changes Aegon's age quite a bit if we do that. And then he removed that. If Aegon being alive during the tourney would have changed the chronology slightly, he was still supposed to be an infant when killed by Gurgur Clegane during the sack. If he were an infant during the tourney, he'd have probably one 1.5 years old during the sack, which in my opinion is beyond the cutoff of an infant. Many one-year-olds can walk. Perhaps others can think of some significance to this, but it's also possible that it just doesn't add anything to the story and was deleted for space. I think that, you know, I'm trying to think like why we think that the Harrenhal tourney was in 81. Because don't they say during a spring? But like at what point? Yeah, it's Storm of Swords, the year of the false spring. So it's like within this book that George places the tourney when it was. It could very well be that George wanted the tourney closer to the rebellion, like in 282 or something. And only later was he like pushing it back. So it's hard to say, because the pushing of the tourney back changes everything. I mean, it changes things about like Ashara being pregnant and who is the father and all sorts of weird stuff and like what happened at the tourney. And, you know, had the Harrenhal been later, it would have been a very different, you know, our calculations on baby swaps and parentage would be different, but. You know, it is what it is. But anyway, anything else to talk about with the Harrenhal tourney and Night of the Laughing Tree and Howland Reed?
No, I think you've pretty much covered that section. Yeah, as for changing Aegon's age, I guess it's easier to have the story be more believable that Varys switched them out.
Yeah, it's true. Whatever. I mean, it's much easier to swap a little baby versus some toddler. Squirming baby that's almost one, you know. Mm-hmm. there are a few small changes in the draft that might provide hints to the nature of the others if you squint. The first of these occurs in the draft version of John 2 as John and Mance are inspecting corpses at the Fist of the First Men. Who did this? No men of woman born. Mance Rayder had been kneeling over a corpse that looked like Brown Bernard, but now he stood. It's very Shakespearean to be like no men of woman born. That's Macbeth.
Yeah, and it's one of the things that the witches tell him, right? The prophecy.
Yeah, that's right.
And doesn't Macduff eventually kill him? And what's
right,
Macduff's
reasoning?
Right,
because he's a C-section baby.
Right.
That's it, you know. Which is, I mean, we all accept it because it's Shakespeare, but yeah, that makes no sense, you know.
Oh, by the way, completely. So you're skipping Arya?
Did I pass? Did I pass Arya? Did I go that fast? Oh crap! I'm sorry. It was just
no. You want to just go back to Arya after we're done?
We'll go back to Arya after the Mage of the Others.
Yeah, short.
One of the unanswered questions about the Others is where they come from. Are they somehow created from humans, or do they have wholly unrelated biology? There's evidence for both positions in the books, but this deleted line could be perhaps taken as a hint that they're unrelated to men. There's no reason to think that Mance is an expert in the Others, but he is a better position to understand than most characters. And George also gives gives his fictional characters unearned wisdom for the sake of storytelling and foreshadowing. There's another deleted example of Mance having correct instincts on the others after instructing Harna to forget Mormont Mance originally said, if the Others did not linger here to raise these dead, it can only mean they're hunting down the living. Mance is right about this, as the very next chapter shows, in which Sam is hunted by and eventually defeats the another. That chapter contains a second possible deleted hint about the creature's nature. At the end of Sam's first A Storm of Swords chapter, after Sam stabs the other with the dragonglass dagger, the published book says that the other tries to pull out the dagger, but where its fingers touched the obsidian, they smoked. Originally, George said that its fingers melted instead of smoked. I think it's very likely that George made this change simply because he liked the imagery of fingers smoking more than melting, but the fact that he considered melting plausible in the first place could be a sign that the others are made of ice or some other elemental matter and not derived from flesh, which does not melt. Yeah, but George is kind of weird, though, with like what burns and what melts. Gold melting, you know, like gold melting and being able to pour it over Viserys's head. Like, no, not at that temperature. But so who knows? But I know at some point George does say that the others are never born.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because of TV, we're all in this idea that the babies are just transformed into others. And so that transformation could say that they're not born, you know, they're transformed and that's where they come from. Like saying like,
but the idea, we discussed this briefly last time, the idea, yeah. And then I think the idea that like, cause we never see the babies actually transforming in the show, at least into the White Walkers, but it's like alluded. Okay, fine. But so the moment the Night King puts his, or whoever it is in the books, puts their hand on the child, the eyes glow blue and then they all of a sudden grow like super quickly.
Oh, I'm just assuming there's like another, first of all, with regards to that baby. Okay. I'm assuming they left him behind north of the wall. And he was like a toddler. And then when Arya stabbed the Night King and all of the guys shattered, that toddler north of the wall shattered. Like that's just what I'm assuming.
But why have the toddler though? Like that's what confuses me. Just like, are they using it for sustenance? Are they eating it?
No.
Like,
he eventually grows up into a full-sized other.
Eventually grows up or grows instantly, like some kind of werewolf transformation.
Think about the instantaneous, but yeah, I mean, I just figured he eventually grew up and into an old other. Maybe they used the young ones for like manual labor back in other city. someone's gotta like, you know, run the trains and clean up the, you know, make the food, clean
Preston,
the streets,
the children,
of other city.
The White Walker children yearn for the mines, Preston, don't you know?
Yeah, they're working in the mines. It's only the super old ones that go out attacking people.
Because yeah, they specifically all look like old men and like some have beards and whatnot. Remember that? But this is in the show. Whatever. The show, books is different. By the way, completely random. I've never asked you this question in regards to the White Walkers in the show. This is one of the things that you and I have discussed about the show, how the show did a lot of things better than the books. I have to throw in another one. I like White Walkers better than the others. I don't know. White Walkers sounds more fantasy-ish. It sounds more mystical. It sounds
Oh, I
like
see,
creepy.
yeah.
I've never liked the others, or even Neverborn sounds kind of lame.
Yeah,
Just, I don't know. White Walkers sounds more ancient, mystical, creepy.
I see what you're saying. Others, I mean, others has more thematic weight, but if we're going with the show, they never leaned into the thematic weight. Because like you use the word other, and we think of like, otherizing immigrants or something, otherizing, Russians in our, in the world of warfare and our cultures otherize other cultures, right? To make them the foreigners, to make them the outsiders. And when they're the
I like
outsiders, they're
that.
no longer human and we can kill them easily and things like this.
Good point.
But in this situation, the others, at least in the show, are essentially just pure evil, and they should have been otherized. And it's fine that they're otherized, and it's fine that they were killed, And you're like, oh, then what point are you making about war? Oh, none.
Preston, stop it. Don't you know that themes are for eighth grade book reports? Don't you
Right,
know?
themes are made for 8th grade book reports. Now, so here's the thing. When you say, I guess when I say I like the term other, it's only because I have assumed that other is referring to, the anthropological, sociological term of the other, and that George is making a statement about that. If George is not making a statement about that, then I think you're completely correct, Carmine, that White Walker is a better name. Then it's just like, oh, then what? Then why did George choose the term other? Oh, no reason. Oh, you weren't
I
referring
like
to
your
the
ex
sociological,
I like
anthropological term of other? Oh, fuck. Should have just called them White Walkers.
I like your term better. But no, it's like
But it
names.
completely assumes it completely assumes that like George is taking the story in that direction, that the others aren't completely evil and things like that, but I don't know.
To non-book readers, the White Walkers, the others, they don't appear that often in the books. Ever, like
No.
we I feel as though up until when the show stops adapting the books, we had slightly more appearances of the Walkers in the show than we did the others in the books. Pretty
Oh
sure.
yeah, I mean the show has a lot more references to the others. I mean to the White Walkers, like because. Essentially, we get of the others themselves, you have Waymar Royce fighting one, and then you have Sam like attacking one, like, and that's it. Sam killing one, and Waymar Royce.
Isn't there an off-screen battle in both book and show, at the Fist of the First Men? That's off-screen, though.
Right, but it might just be whites.
True, 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 true.
Right?
But
Like
in
the
the
Fist of the
show, we know
First Men could be
specifically.
all whites. Hardhome could be all whites. Jaffer Flowers and whoever, like that's whites. We
But in the
have
show,
no.
Season two ends with Sam seeing a White Walker general leading a white army. So technically that counts. And of course, Hard Home, that counts too. That's technically book territory. Season
Yeah.
five, for those of you who don't know, season five is where like the book adaptations end. So yeah, we have slightly more of them in the show than we do in the books. Huh.
Yeah.
George said when Winds of Winter comes out, we'll go further north and deal with that. So who knows?
All right. On to the aria that I missed. Okay. So, another small wording change with potential significance to the story's endgame occurs in the drafts of A Storm of Swords, Aria 4, when word of the Kingslayer's release reaches Arya and her captors in the Brotherhood Without Banners. In both the draft and published versions, Arya is ordered outside by Greenbeard when the conversation turns to Jaime's release by Catelyn. But in the draft, Arya remains infuriated by the rumor outside and says something interesting. It's not true. Arya told herself as she ran out a back door. It couldn't be true. Behind the sept, an archery butt had been set up, and Angai was giving Gendry a lesson in the longbow. They took one look at her and lowered their bows. "What's wrong?" asked Gendry. "It's just a lie," Arya told him angrily, almost shouting. She never would. If she did, I'd kill her too. "Who?" "Her," Arya shouted. She couldn't bring herself to say her mother's name to them. Now, before we go on, I wanted to say that rereading now A Game of Thrones, there is just a lot of placed favorite, like obvious favoritism of Sansa over Arya. That's not just imagined by Arya, but real and legitimate, like in Catelyn's head. Like Catelyn in A Game of Thrones just clearly likes Sansa more and clearly likes Bran more. She likes Bran more than Robin and Rickon, and she likes Sansa more than Arya. Like she definitely plays favorites. And so
Sansa, I can understand because I feel as though Sansa has more in common with her mother than Arya would.
Sure, but it's Bran? Also very, I don't know. I mean, I don't know what's going on in other people's heads, but there is now being a parent, like I actively try to like feel that I love both of my children equally. Like, that you don't have a Sophie's choice, you know, like if there's a Sophie's choice with Catelyn, it's just like so clearly Sansa over Arya and so clearly Bran over the other two kids. Like, it's just like the other two boys, you know? However, it begins changing later on. Cause I think in A Storm of Swords, Kat like specifically challenges Rob about disinheriting Arya and writing his will and not talking about not giving things to Arya. And when we get to A Feast for Crows with Arya names herself Cat of the Canals as like she's trying to remember her mother, and there's more of like this idea of missing and loving her mother I think maybe like George had just more distance between Kat and Arya that he decided to undo and be like, no, that's just not realistic. Like Arya's a little girl. Of course she's going to love her mother. And of course Kat is going to love her daughter. Like, of course, you know? So, I mean, it's not a subject I've like researched specifically, but it's just something I'm feeling right now. Having just rereading the beginning of A Game of Thrones and being like, huh, Kat's really, really a jerk to Arya, and Arya has real problems with her mother. And then they're like, oh, that's not just like, you know, typical family argument. It's like legitimate. And like Arya's going to kill her mom. Like Arya wants to kill her mom. A few readers have hypothesized that Arya is destined to kill Lady Stoneheart and that doing that could bring closure to both Stoneheart and Arya's arcs. It does seem inevitable that Stoneheart will eventually meet one of her children again. Un-Catelyn still deserves a modicum of closure and comfort, and Arya is as likely as any, given that George tried to connect them late in Storm via Nymeria's retrieval of Catelyn's body. Yeah, that's the other thing. Arya's trying so desperately to get to Catelyn at the Red Wedding. You need to establish like that love of like, oh my God, I got to get to my mom. I got to get to protection. If she's like, oh, I'm going to kill my mom because she because she let Jamie out of jail.
I also want, I strongly disagree with the idea that it'll be Arya who ends up killing Lady Stoneheart. I think
I do too.
Yeah, it's Brienne or Jamie's story right there. Oh, yeah, mostly Brienne.
It's thematically, Lady Stoneheart has little to do with Arya. I mean, Kat might, but you'd have to close things off with Jamie and Brienne and then move Lady Stoneheart into another different direction to bring it back to like to Arya and Sansa. It's just
I also think the idea that Arya will be around the Riverlands area, if we're following the show where Arya eventually goes back to the Riverlands to kill the Freys, if Lady Stoneheart will even be alive by then. Like I don't see how that would happen in the books. There's no way Jaime and Brienne leave that situation with Lady Stoneheart with everyone alive.
Yeah, I mean, the I've been obviously mulling this over a lot in the fanfic, you know, and it's like when I'm really thinking about like, okay, Brienne's story, if Brienne is really talking about, you know, the nature of morality and in the same sense as Jaime, she needs to kill Lady Stoneheart in the same way that Jaime killed Aerys. Because that's the whole idea that we shouldn't think that vowing your allegiance to someone and passing the puck on morality is good, right? So like Lady Stoneheart, Brienne is bound to follow Lady Stoneheart. She and Lady Stoneheart told her to kill Jaime, and it's like, well, you know that like Brienne can't do that. So like Brienne's not gonna fucking kill Jaime, you know. So it's, you know, she's got to do something like kill Lady Stoneheart in the same way as Aerys, and that breaks her, that frees her. But at the same time, like, what do you do? Like, is Lady Stoneheart gone after that, or do you have like Lady Stoneheart rise the same way Beric Dondarrion did? You like stab her, and she collapses, and then she just gets up again, like Beric Dondarrion did. And you're like, ah, oh, fuck. Then you could say like, okay, Brienne and Jaime are resolved, and you can do something else with Lady Stoneheart. And then maybe Lady Stoneheart could meet Sansa or Arya or whoever. Littlefinger, but you need to have her role in the Brienne and Jaime story. But anyway,
that's actually I'm sorry, before we move on from that topic, yeah. That's such a good point. I also didn't realize that Catelyn's body, after, you know, they cut her throat and threw her in the river, her body must be so fucking, like, it must be so fucked up.
More fucked up than Beric. Yeah.
Right. So what can put her down for good? Valyrian steel?
That's true. And who carries Valyrian steel? You know, Brienne. And I mean, there's a certain irony of, like, killing the person that you've made an oath with with a sword called Oathkeeper. Like, oh my god, it's just like the irony of it, right? Like, that you're breaking your oath with
video.
You're literally breaking your oath with a sword called Oathkeeper.
I wonder if afterwards she'll give Jaime the sword back because she broke her oath, and he's like, nah, keep it. Oathbreaker, wear it proudly.
Yeah, I mean, he can go get Widow's Wail or whatever.
Oh, there it is.
But Widow's Wail is back in King's Landing with Tommen. Let's see. Anyway, even if that line was significant, it was written 25 and deleted 25 years ago. That's true. I mean, at this point. There are a few other small changes in the Arya draft. While traveling with the Brotherhood, there's a deleted mention of the group visiting an underground river. That's interesting. A few days later, the searchers sheltered down below the ground in torchlit cavern beside the underground river. One of the cave dwellers said the Lightning Lord had gone to White Crown. Another insisted that he'd been at Acorn Hill. So this, you know, it's just, there's a million parallels to the Brotherhood Without Banners and their situation and stuff going on north of the wall. Beric Dondarrion sits on a Weirwood throne underground. Like, he sits on a throne of roots. He has one eye. He's under the earth in a hollow hill. It's the exact same situation as Bloodraven, one eye, Weirwood throne, beneath the earth, beneath where a tree was. I mean, Beric is, the Weirwood's gone, but they're still in the hollow hill where the Weirwood was. You know, having an underground river is, you know, just more, I mean, more similarities.
Also clearly a reference to you. It's not much, yeah. But those who suspect that Westeros is riddled with an underground network of caverns might find that interesting.
That's true. The reference to White Crown is the original name of High Heart, the hill ringed by ancient Weirwood stumps. Oh, right. So the crown, like Queen's Crown, White Crown would be like Weirwood. The Weirwoods would make the crown. And in the same lore, but gets much less prose in the draft. No character like the Ghost of High Heart exists in this version. Huh. I mean, I guess the Ghost of High... Yeah, the Ghost of High Heart is just... It is kind of a tacked on thing that doesn't really add anything. It just adds some prophecies. Fills some pages. And you can't really like comment.
Prophecies are fun.
They are. People love it. People fucking love the Ghost of High Heart. And he needs to finish the book to know which prophecies he's going to shove in, right?
I guess, yeah.
Arya's chapter traveling with the Brotherhood also includes hint of a deleted subplot. When they arrive at Acorn Hill, yeah, Lady Smallwood is... I always am just like, what's the significance of this Lady Smallwood stuff? When they arrive at Acorn Hill, Lady Smallwood informs them of an ominous-sounding singer named Honeytongue, who is searching for Beric Dondarrion. Smallwood says that Honeytongue wants to find Beric and make him into a song, he claims, which sounds a lot like a not very subtle assassin to me. Smallwood says that she directed him to the Inn of the Kneeling Man. Perhaps George meant for him to kill Sharna and husband, the inn's current occupants. Huh. Honeytongue. There's also an interesting change to Sandor Clegane's dialogue when Arya tries to kill him after he defeats Beric. The draft of that chapter contains some deleted lines indicating some serious self-loathing underneath his main exterior. "You killed Micah," she said once more in a voice gone soft and small. "I did." His voice broke, and then he began to cry. "Mother of mercy, I did. I wrote him down, and I cut him in half. And the little bird, the pretty little bird, I let them beat her. Gods be good, girl. Do it. You hear me? Do it." That material is mostly cut and moved to, you know, a song, A Storm of Swords, Arya 13. Where that's when he begs for the gift of mercy. But in this context, Sandor's confession functions partly as manipulation to get her to end his suffering. In the draft context, his self-loathing seems more honest. Yeah, that's true. Absolutely.
I like that.
Yeah. Now the move is definitely a really great. Because G-Steph is correct that like him begging her to kill him, you don't know if he's trying to goad her into killing him and he's using whatever methods possible, or if he actually really does feel bad about Micah. You know, could go either way.
¿Por qué no las dos?
Yeah. Anyway, that was, yeah, George did very well moving it. It shouldn't be that early on.
The Honeytongue one, random.
Yeah.
I know someone in the comments to this post is theorizing that could that be Jockin, but no, Jockin is in Old Town, or so we think.
Yeah, by a storm of swords, yeah, he should be gone. Yeah, honey tongue. Make him into a song. But it's another one of those things about, song, person being a memory, being a song, afterlife. All right. The Red Wedding. The July 1999 draft of A Storm of Swords doesn't include the Red Wedding itself. George has said it was the last chapter he wrote for Storm, but it does include some deleted foreshadowing that may affect your theories about how it was planned. Here's the original final page of A Storm of Swords, Tyrion 3, Tyrion's first small council meeting with Tywin. The interesting thing about this passage is Tywin's reference to Tyrion building his chain back in Clash. This suggests that Tywin was somehow planning Rob's death long before Rob had even met Jane Westerling. Let me see this. Am I reading this correctly? Let me think here. The foreshadowing strikes me as problematic on multiple levels. It weakens the shock impact of the Red Wedding itself and shows Tywin hinting way too casually to others about an incredibly sensitive plot, and requires an implausible level of foresight from Tywin, especially during the chaos of the war. So I'm glad the passage was deleted. He says, Robb Stark is as capable as I am, presumably, and sworn to marry one of those fertile Freys. And once the young wolf sires a litter, any pup that Sansa births are heirs to nothing. Every once in a long while, Tywin Lannister would threaten to smile. He never did. But that threat alone was terrible to behold. Robb Stark will father no children on his fertile Frey. You have my solemn word. Tyrion cocked his head. How can you prevent it? I won't need to. The boy prevented it himself. A man's seed goes cold under the earth, Tyrion. While you were forging your chain for Stannis, I was digging a grave for a direwolf, and young Lord Stark was obliged enough to step in it. All that remains now is for us to throw a little dirt on his face before he can climb out. Now,
How
so.
the huh? Rob stepped into that bullshit with the phrase betraying him on his own when he decided to do what he did with Jane Westerling. There's no way Tywin could have prepared for that or planned for that.
So I'm trying to think. When he slept with Jane Westerling, though, was I'm trying to think. That was after the storming of the crag, right? And the storming of the crag happens in. Trying to think here. Storming of the Crag happens in Clash. The Crag is stormed by night. No, wait. Maybe it happens before. Or it happens like kind of n between where Clash and everything. Here we go. It says, after taking Ashmark along with the Westerman castles, the Starks move on to the Crag. And so that happens in Cat 6, A Clash of Kings. So The thing is, I've kind of been down this. I've once talked about this topic before. So before I became very obsessed with time traveling, Bran. You know, I was going through prophecies and being like, well, they're all bullshit. And most people bring up like, well, what about the Red Wedding? Because Dany clearly sees the Red Wedding at the House of the Undying. How, and then I'll, you know, and so I was like, well, the Red Wedding hadn't happened yet, but the idea for the Red Wedding could have happened. And so if we go back, yeah, there it is. So Catelyn Six, the Blackwater is over here at Davos 3, Tyrion 13, Sansa 6, Tyrion 14. This is the Blackwater over in the 58th, you know, kind of their chapters. Catelyn Six is over at 45. So if Tywin was planning the Red Wedding, like when, like essentially Rob gets injured and the Westerlings send their letter to Tywin and Tywin sends back, you better get your daughter to sleep with Rob Stark. That would be at the same time that Tyrion is forging the chain.
But that also requires Rob to be a dumb fuck, and the whole situation with the way I always saw it was that the reason that happened was because he was in a moment of weakness. He just got injured. You know, the news about his brothers is still on his mind, and getting laid takes his mind off it. Fine, but there's no way Tywin could have.
I mean, I think the thing that's not predictable to me is like I think you can feed a kid Viagra. Plus he's whatever, 15-year-old boy, like, you know, fine, you can throw a girl in his bed and get him to have sex. That's the easy part. The hard part is him afterwards being like, yup, gotta marry her. Like, that's the part that's unbelievable. right? Like, that's the part you can't control. Like, it requires you to, like, even with like this like sense of duty and honor, like In times of war, like someone wouldn't just be like, no, not this time, not the one I have a war and I need the phrase. Like, that's the part that's unbelievable, is that they knew Rob would actually marry Jane Westerling rather than just
being unbelievable. Like, Tywin's a great strategist, but the motherfucker's not out here playing 7D chess. Like, there's no way.
So, I mean, the thought of Tywin having come up with the Red Wedding very early, and as early as when the vision appears in the House of the Undying. Yeah, that's one, you know. But I mean, it's very much implied that it's at least implied that yes, the Westerlings did throw their daughter at Rob, because they got no punishment. They got no punishment. In fact, they were rewarded later. So it seems like they did do something. So I do, you know, I do think that even though it doesn't really make any sense to like know that Rob was going to marry this woman, I think it's pretty much implied that yes, like they threw their daughter in there. And we're
happy. What punishment
happy
should they get though from Rob?
What? Right. I mean, I don't know how they ensured that he married her, but there's no reason that the daughter should be in there taking care of Rob. Like, that's just in any normal circumstance, she shouldn't be in there. There should be a maester in there, no one else. You don't throw your daughter. You don't, you know. I mean, I was talking to my sister about like my nephew, and you know, he was invited to a he's 14 and he was invited to a sleepover where there was going to be girls, and My you know, my sister's like, nah, let's not do that. You know, like, and this is a totally different time. You know, like, you're not throwing your daughter in there to take care of Rob, unless you want her to sleep with Rob. So, you know, I do think that, like, yes, it was the plan. That
Sleep with
was the
Rob
plan.
in the hopes that she softens him enough to give them like an easier time to like not behead everybody in there, which that was always my assumption. My whole thing is the reason the Red Wedding plans came together was the moment Roose Bolton learned about Rob and Jane, and Vargo Hope brought Jamie to him. This was a perfect opportunity for Roose, and then that's how the plan came together. There's no way, yeah. You're right, it's unbelievable. No way.
I mean, some would say, like, the biggest line that kind of shows that was left in is Tywin says some wars are won with Quill. He says some wars are won. Some battles are won with sword and spears, others are with quills and ravens. So a lot of people point to that. That's Tyrion 3, A Storm of Swords. So, oh, he says that, I'm sorry, he says that in Tyrion 1. Tyrion thinks about it again, but he says, some battles are won with swords and spears, others with quills and ravens. So some people say that, okay, what was left in the book is that Tyrion or Tywin was already thinking about the Red Wedding in Tyrion 1, A Storm of Swords, which is well. I mean, that's before we even hear about Rob arriving to shock Catelyn. So it can't just be the Red Wedding, can't just be like, oh, they heard about the marriage, let's capitalize on it. It had to have been happening before that. So this just makes it. So I mean, anyway, G Steph says, look, he says the foreshadowing strikes me as problematic on multiple levels. It weakens the shock impact of the Red Wedding, and it shows that Tywin's hinting way too casually about its sensitive plot. I mean, he kind of hints at it pretty casually in Tyrion 1, 2. And it requires an implausible level of foresight for Tywin during the chaos of war. The story still does that. I'm glad this passage was deleted. I'm fine, you know, yeah, I'm fine it's deleted too, but I'm saying George still left in all of that stuff. He already makes Tywin's foresight unbelievable.
Give us an example of that.
I'm just talking like saying that some wars are won with quills and ravens is saying that he planned the Red Wedding as early as Tyrion 1. That's before most people know, certainly Tywin, that Rob has
No,
married.
I meant like examples of Tywin's insane foresight in the published version.
That's what I'm talking about. The quills and ravens thing is published.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I misunderstood you.
Yeah. I'm saying that this pushes it back a bit, but it doesn't change very much. Like Tywin conspiring with the Westerlings to have Jane Westerling seduce Rob. Like that already makes Tywin like ridiculous. Because there's no way that he would have been able to actually predict that Rob would have married her. It's just a level of understanding of a boy that goes beyond. Because even Cat, here's the problem with it, okay? One would think Catelyn would know her own son better than Tywin. And yet even Catelyn is shocked that Rob went as far as marrying her after sleeping with her. So, like, somehow Tywin knows Rob better than Catelyn. But anyway, anyway, we're beating this dead horse. I'm sorry. Anyway, I generally don't look at the final drafts during library visits, but my time is limited because my time is limited. But I made the exception for the Red Wedding. Here's the late draft of the second to last page of the chapter. With copy editing annotations. As you can see, Catelyn's death was originally more gruesome. It had her raking her face with her nails. She tore off her lips and ears. The copy editor said that it was too much. Oh, I see.
Yeah, that was unnecessary.
The birds bore off her lips that Ned had kissed and ripped the ears from her head that had heard him pledge his love. Is that what that word is? Birds? Yeah. Okay. It hurts so much. Our children, Ned, all our sweet babes, Rick and Bran, Arya, Sansa, Rob, please. Ned, make it stop. Make it stop hurting. The white tears and red ones ran together until her face was torn and tattered, her face that Ned had loved. The birds bore off her lips that Ned had kissed and ripped off the ears that had heard him pledge his love. Catelyn raised her hands and watched the blood run down her long fingers over her wrists beneath the sleeves of her gown. Like slow red worms, it crawled all the way through her arms and her clothes. It tickles. It made me laugh until she screamed. Mad, someone said. She's lost her wits. Someone else said, make an end. And a hand grabbed her scalp, just as she'd done with Jingle Bell. And she thought, no, no, don't cut my hair. Ned loves my hair. The steel was at her throat, and the bite was red and cold. They cut copy editor cut that out. That's probably true. Too much. I'll cover the remainder vaguely interesting things from Storm. Sam's flashback, the Battle of the Fist, was originally included Dolorous Edd saying, the first time since we've been here that I don't have a night watch, and let's see what happens. I think George should have kept that line. That's true, but I guess he didn't want it to be too funny. Maybe we'll steal that, put it back in. After Tywin shows Tyrion the two Valyrian steel swords he'd created from the Metal of Ice, there's a deleted line which Tywin mentions that Robert owned a bronze rune blade 6,000 years old, a dragonglass dirk made by the children of the forest, and doubtless hundreds more. The reference to the dragonglass dirk is the same in the same book that John discovers a cache of them, and Sam used one to kill another. It was likely meant as a hint to the reader that where John's stash originally came from.
Does he mean where Robert's stash originally came from?
Well, see, here's what I'm confused in this wording. A bronze rune blade, 6,000 years old, a dragonglass dirk made by the children of the forest, and doubtless hundreds more. Doubtless hundreds more. Is that referring to just any dagger, or does it specifically mean dragonglass daggers? Because I take it as...
It almost seems like Robert has, at least in the vaults or something, I don't know, like more artifacts, because he's listing off a bunch of artifacts.
Right, but I don't think it means he has hundreds of dragonglass daggers. I think it might just mean he has hundreds of daggers. And then the reference to a dragonglass dirk in the same book that John discovers the cache was likely meant as a hint to the reader where John's stash originally came from. Or maybe a red herring. Like the idea that somehow... The stash of dragonglass was taken from Robert's armory at Winterfell and then brought north of the wall and stashed that. Or is he just Or is he? Oh, I think G-Stuff is just talking about from the children of the forest, that the stash came from the children of the forest, that it was buried by the children of the forest, I think is maybe what's being said here. I'm sorry. Now it seems rather clear that we're supposed to think that the children buried that stash rather than anybody else. On the topic of swords, the ancient Lannister family, Sword Brightroar was originally named Blackroar. John's first chapter contains another blatant hint that he'll live on as ghost after dying. After Harna threatens John, Varamyr, who was originally named Rendhor in the draft, says, "If you mean to kill him, I'd best hunt down that direwolf, or his shade will soon be stalking us." Yeah, okay.
There it is.
But I mean, Aurel's eagle already has that in it, because he's like he talk they already talk about like Aurel's eagle having the shade of Aurel in him, and the hatred of John living on in it. There's a deleted Sansa flashback in which she meets Dantos in the Godswood and rejects his rescue plan in the belief that she'll soon be going to Highgarden to marry Willis Tyrell. By the end of the chapter, she's married to Tyrion. And in the published book, Jaime successfully saves Brienne from being raped by the Brave Companions via the Sapphire's Ruse. In the draft, Brienne is raped repeatedly and after a while fully submits to it, lying there like a dead fish as it happens. Going this
Jesus.
way would have made, it would have made Brienne a broken character and harder to find inspiration in. Plus, it would have weakened the connection between Jaime and Brienne and the cruelty of her ultimately betraying him. I mean, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the whole thing is that like Jaime sacrifices his hand to, or no, I'm trying to piecing everything together. No, he gets beaten over and over again. His hand gets taken immediately. So I guess he doesn't sacrifice his hand, but his hand is taken immediately, but he's beaten over and over again in order to save Brienne. So at least he's there's that sacrifice. Yeah. So yeah, I agree that it's probably best that they remove that. And that's the conclusion there. Yeah. All right. Anything else? Because this
That last part, my God, that got a little dark. I'm glad finally
yeah,
this.
that's how we're ending things. He says, "This concludes Act Two of my research of George's A Song of Ice and Fire draft. I hope you've enjoyed reading it as much as I've enjoyed writing it. I look forward to returning to College Station one final time for Act Three, if and when Winds is released, to study the current closed drafts of Dance with Dragons." This is what G7 was talking about with there are certain drafts that are not open to the public. Thanks, as always, to the staff of the Cushing Library who cannot have been more helpful. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer your questions. Yeah, and I guess, let's thank G-Stuff for all of his work heading to the library,
Of
making the
course,
trip.
we gotta have him on and just, shoot the shit with him. I'm sure he has way more information that he hasn't put on here. We can ask him
Right, I
about
think things he
the
may have
trip.
forgotten or something like that, things that weren't covered.
I know for a fact that he has a lot to say in regards to George's dealings with various video game publishers and how there have been people trying to get a game made from Game of Thrones for quite some time, amongst other people trying to scam George. Remember, for those of you who don't remember, I had conversations with G-Stef beforehand, and yeah, he has a lot more to say on that. So pretty soon we'll have him on, and we'll just shoot the shit with him.
Yeah, that'd be great. But yeah, I mean, all of his work is really fantastic. I mean, some of the best. I mean, I can't think of, since the, I would say like since the release of the Forsaken chapter, what has been more enlightening and on the nature of like the story, you know, than his research and going and looking through the drafts, like nothing, you know, right?
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree. After having such a large content drought for 10 plus years, yeah, I mean, what else can you say? But other than he's made very big contributions to the fandom.
Yeah, fantastic stuff. Fantastic stuff. All right. Well, thank you for sticking with us, and we'll talk to you next time. All right. Bye.